Good morning. Let me adjust this again. I want to begin in Sesame Street. There's a moment, I think, where it says something here is not like the other. One of these things does not make sense, which is sort of how I feel on this panel. Eric and Carol are dear friends. They are members of my congregation, and to have Eric stand and say that Daniel is my rabbi is humbling. And as John joked, follow that. The scholarship and the depth of knowledge that you have heard in the first two presentations is not something that I can certainly aspire to it, but not hope to achieve it. And so what I would like to do is to set that aside and to try to spend a few minutes this morning speaking not as from a perspective of biblical scholarship, but as a practitioner. Because biblical scholars and the world of the university contribute greatly to the practice of modern religion. And there are differences, different challenges that ministers, that rabbis, imams face as we steward communities that revere these texts as sacred. And therefore, as we teach these texts and present these texts, we must do so in a way that reflects a commitment to those texts and a perspective of being claimed by those texts. And within that position of being claimed, we have to navigate a commitment to those texts and also a great caution against their misuse. So what I would like to do for my few minutes is to cultivate within this room what I will call a passionate moderation, that we must claim and take back from extremists and take back from literalists and take back from those who I believe misuse scripture towards violent means, and take those texts back and the interpretation of those texts back, and to articulate many different strategies that are not only at our disposal, but that we must use as practitioners of religion in modern America. I want to begin with two philosophical approaches or frameworks. Number one, for me as a rabbi and as a person who is committed to God, the first thing that I believe when I proclaim a belief in God is that God is God and I am not. And so the beginning of the religious journey is the beginning of a journey of radical humility. And what that humility means in the face of textual interpretation is that we can assert that what we have before us is a divinely given text, although historicization of the text is an important thing for all of us to learn about and to struggle with, and I think even incorporate into our religious approaches. But I can affirm that I have a divinely given text, but that immediately leads me to the second statement, which is, I, as a flawed human being, do not, and nor does anybody else, possess a perfect understanding of that text. And therefore, be very, very careful when approaching a text and claiming that it leads us, God forbid, in the direction of violence. With that said, I also bring forward a second approach from the French existentialist Jewish philosopher from the mid-20th century, Emmanuel Levinas, who, in writing about our approach to texts, says that we ought to, in our interpretation of text, cultivate a respect for the otherness of the text, based on the conviction that a renewed effort at interpretation will disclose insights latent in the text, rather than the presumption that we have superseded whatever the text might have to offer us. And therefore, as strange as it might seem, I approach texts, even terrible and horrible texts, and I ask myself, what can I learn from this? What are the possible teachings that I might learn from this? And Carol just finished beautifully illustrating for us a way in which an initial reading of a biblical story, which can be seen wrongly to sanction violence, can be understood in a very different way to teach us something about covenant and the importance of remaining in covenant. So I want to take a look or approach a few texts in this way. Number one, the Jewish holiday of Passover just finished. And as Eric mentioned, we read the story of the Passover. We read the story of the destruction of the Egyptians. We read the story of God and the 10 plagues. And there are many ways in which the Jewish tradition tempers that story, those plagues. Quite famously, if you have been to a Passover Seder, you know that in each of the four cups of wine symbolize something. The second cup of wine is drunk after telling the story of the Passover. And as part of that section of the Seder, the tradition is to dip one's finger into the cup of wine and to take out a drop of wine for each one of the plagues, to symbolize the wine as a symbol of joy. But our joy is incomplete because the redemption that took place in the time of Exodus is incomplete because it necessitated violence. So we have ways of tempering those texts. Quite famously, the rabbis also tell a story about the singing at the Song of the Sea, that the Jewish people, the Israelites, begin to sing, and the angels come and start to sing along, and God says to the angels, interestingly, not to the human beings, but to the angels, "My creatures are drowning in the sea. How can you sing songs of joys?" And God quiets the angels. Now, seeming to allow the people to sing as an understanding that sometimes when we are redeemed from oppression, even when others are destroyed, we experience a sense of joy or relief. Okay? And I'll talk more about that giving voice in a few minutes. But there are ways in which this is tempered. And yet many biblical scholars also point out that when we look at the text itself, there are other ancient Near Eastern texts which feature gods who fight to establish order, but the biblical text features a god who is not only establishing order, but who is establishing order and justice. So the first thing that I want to point out about many biblical texts is that while God is violent in those texts, it is not a wanton violence. It's not a random violence. It is a violence that is in the service of justice. And and asking ourselves the question, what are the times when justice needs, when injustice needs to be not only spoken against, when we don't need more thoughts and prayers, but we need to act? The Bible is pointing us towards moments when God engages in the world for just purposes. Number two, I want to point out that the Bible itself in that story in the Exodus 14:14, Adonai yilachem lachem va'atem tacharishun, God will fight for you. You need just be quiet, be still. So the second thing which I want to point out in those texts is that it is God who acts and not human beings. And therefore, as we read the texts, it's a mistake to read those texts and say, ah, God does that, and therefore it's a sanction for me to do so as well. But rather, we see God acting, and it is actually arrogance to presume the role of God. What God asks in many of those moments is, I will do this, you should be still. Number three, there are times in the biblical text, however, where the psalmist, and the psalm that I'm going to choose is a psalm that we actually said this morning in the Jewish liturgy, it's the psalm for Wednesday, Psalm 94, where we read, it begins, Adonai, the Lord is a God of vengeance. God, O God who avenges, shine forth, rise up, judge of the earth, pay back the proud what they deserve. Now, I will tell you that a few years ago, I had someone, and I don't want to become too political here, but I'm telling the anecdote. We had someone in our congregation who was a great devotee of President Obama, and quite liberal in her orientation, and we would read this on Wednesday morning after services, and she would say, I don't like this psalm so much, right? Because it feels strange to call out and to say, God, pay, you know, O God who avenges, shine forth, right? It sticks in our throat. And yet, who these days, she relates to it quite differently. I'll continue the psalm. How long, Lord, will the wicked, how long will the wicked be jubilant? They pour out arrogant words. All the evildoers are full of boasting. They crush your people, Lord. They oppress your inheritance. They slay the widow and the foreigner. They murder the fatherless. They say the Lord does not see. The God of Jacob takes no notice. Take notice, you senseless ones among the people, you fools. I'm just reading the psalm. And so this phenomenon is one where we find the Bible giving voice to the voice of those who are oppressed, not calling for violence on behalf of human beings, but asking God to intervene on the side of those who are oppressed. I want to share some Jewish dirty laundry in this moment. Hey, Eric said, oh boy, right? So this morning I teach, it's on Facebook, so this is, I need to share it publicly. This is publicly available. I teach a class Wednesday mornings after our services on the Exodus, on the book of Exodus. And we've been going through verse by verse, reading, translating from the Hebrew to the English, and looking at the medieval commentaries. We've been doing this once a week for about 3.5 years. We're now on chapter 14. We move slowly, but carefully. And we've reached this part in the story where it says that the Israelite people have left and were camped at the sea, and Pharaoh changes Pharaoh's mind, And it says Pharaoh gets all of the chariots and the horses and comes after the Israelite people. And the medieval commentators, the Jewish commentators pay very close attention to the Jewish text. And they ask the question, where did the animals come from? The Egyptians, and they cite the verses, the Egyptian animals were all destroyed in the plagues. And the Israelite animals, Moses says to Pharaoh, we're taking all of our animals with us. So the rabbis want to know, where did they get the horses? It's a good question. They cite earlier in one of the plagues, there's a moment where the Bible says that some of the Egyptians, because of the plagues, feared God and brought their animals and their servants indoors. And presumably that saved them from some of the plagues. So what that means is that Pharaoh changes his mind and says, I need animals. And the rabbis don't go into this, but either those people, those Egyptians, Pharaoh says, I want your animals. A charitable reading says, I want your animals, and Pharaoh takes them as the king. An uncharitable reading says, the Egyptians offer up their animals and say, go get them. This leads the rabbis to say, quite unflatteringly, the only good Egyptian is a dead Egyptian. Because they say, look, even earlier in the story, there were these Egyptians who feared God enough to bring their animals indoors, and now they've offered them up, and they are used to hunt down the Israelites by the sea. Now, when I read that, and by the way, they even go a little worse. They not only say that about the Egyptians, but I'm sad to say they say that about Gentiles. Now, when I read that, what I said to my community this morning is that Jewish voice in those commentaries is the voice of an oppressed people. It's the voice of an oppressed people who say, this is how we feel. Ibn Ezra was writing in medieval Spain. He was based on a midrash that was taking place in the Roman Christian Empire, in a time when obviously Jews were oppressed, and it was giving voice to that. And what I said to my community is twofold. Number one, I think that sometimes the Jewish community can react too strongly when we hear negative language from those who are oppressed. And we need to understand that language in context, that sometimes people who are oppressed call out to God, and it may not be pretty, right? And yet it's reflective not of the ideal of what should be, but reflective of that experience. And we need to attune our ears to hear the pain in the voice without giving license to the end product. Okay? But when we hear the psalmist say, El Nekamot Hofia, God of vengeance appear. Number one, it's a human being calling out and feeling pain and asking for God to intervene. And we as pastors can affirm the pain in that voice and also note that it is God who is being asked to intervene and not human beings. And yet, there is also human violence. I just want to check my time here. There's also human violence. There is the violence in particular of the taking of the land of Canaan in the book of Joshua and other places. Deuteronomy 7:6, one example, you shall destroy all the peoples that the Lord your God delivers to you, showing them no pity, and you shall not worship their gods, for that would be a snare for you, etc., etc. And I'll note two things about this. Number one, within, and I say this really not as an apologetic, within the language of the Bible, we should note, okay, and I'm the Bible as a organic whole, we should note that in Genesis 15:16, when God describes the giving of the land to Abraham's descendants, the Bible itself says, in the fourth generation, your descendants will come back from here, from Egypt. Why in the fourth generation and not immediately? For the sin of the Amorites has not yet reached its full measure. In other words, the very basis of the Israelites displacing the Canaanite people from the land is justice. Is actually a biblical calculus of what the rabbis called midah keneged midah, that the people in the lands have not yet sinned enough to merit the punishment of being displaced. And so while, and the point being is that the Bible itself, we can feel discomfort with the violence of those stories, but we also should not miss the values of justice. And I teach this to my community. The very idea of the covenant and the land for the Jewish people is that the land is given to the Jewish people on the condition of justice. And to the extent that the Israelite people live the covenant in the land, then they will merit it. And when they don't, then they will also be pushed out of the land. But in the covenant itself, the violence which is demanded later, when God says, you, the Israelites, are to go in and to commit these acts of violence, is not wanton, but takes place within a certain calculus. And so the demand for justice is one of those teachings that I try to glean from there. And yet, with all of that said, there are problems, okay? And I want to acknowledge those problems. And I want to finish my time by suggesting a few strategies that we must use in dealing with those problems. Number one is that as practitioners of religion, we must, as Carol said so beautifully, put these texts in context. And the important way to do that for practitioners is by using the Bible to fight the Bible. Okay? In other words, you can't go to somebody and say, well, just ignore these things because they're not important. You have to, but you can say to someone, you're bringing me one text, but we need to look at a much bigger whole. And the values of the Bible often contradict each other. And the second thing which I would say is then, therefore, we as practitioners need to practice an ethic of making sure that biblical texts are not used to sanction violence. And here I want to be very clear. This may sound unmodern, but I am not a believer in the egalitarian reading of the Bible. I think one of the most dangerous things in the practice of modern religion is the idea that any individual can open up the Bible and decide what the Bible means. I believe that pastors and imams and rabbis need to assert their authority as bearers of the tradition who have been trained. And in the Jewish tradition, I will say that the rabbis, we teach before. When we have a blessing in the Jewish tradition, Ahava Rabba Ahavtanu Adonai Eloheinu, God, you have loved us with a great love. What is the way in which the Jewish people know that we have been loved with a great love by God? It is by the fact that we have been given the Torah and law. In the Jewish tradition, law is not an impediment to God or a stumbling block. Law is a great gift. And the great gift of law in the modern era is to say that law is slow, okay? And to Eric's point, right? What I said when I was being asked about performing gay marriages is, I can't answer this question in a vacuum. I need to be in the community first. And that came out of a very deep understanding of the way that Jewish law works. And ultimately, when I made that decision, I didn't just wake up in the morning and make that decision. I looked at the text and I leaned into the Committee on Jewish Law and Standards, as John mentioned in my introduction, that worked through these traditions. I have a hermeneutical tradition that is slow and that is not, that says very clearly, Judaism is not what one individual Jew says it means. That the meaning of Judaism is actually vested in rabbinic authority. And therefore, if you want to know what a particular Bible verse means, it's not up to you to decide. And I will finish that with all of those things said, within Judaism and outside of Judaism, the process of historicization is critical. The rabbis themselves said, as one example, to come back to the tribes in the land, we don't know who the tribes are anymore. And therefore, it is illegal for you to say, therefore, these laws apply to anybody you know. Nobody you know is Amalek. Nobody you know is a Hittite. Nobody you know is any of these people in the land. And therefore, and in those whole set of laws are off the table. That's part of the rabbinic tradition. And I would encourage each of us, I'll close just by saying that as we wrestle with these texts, each of us has an obligation to dig into the interpretive traditions of our traditions and to lean upon them to make sure that they lead us away from violence and towards peace, away from darkness and towards light. Thank you.